Southern Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. For a woman to open a successful business in the 1930s was remarkable. For a Black woman, almost unheard of. Even if they managed to get one started, local officials were constantly revising or adding to oppressive laws to shut them down. Of course, that all depended on what a woman was selling. Even the most pious of elected townsmen were willing to look the other way for what we have long called the world's oldest profession. A tenacious Black woman named Nellie Jackson ignored the laws and mores of her time and yet operated her business pretty much out in the open. That's not to say she wasn't careful. She was, but she also enjoyed a certain level of protection and respect from local officials. That was in part because of where she did business, in Natchez, Mississippi, a river town that, as so many others, was much more receptive to drinking, gambling, and houses of ill repute. The town predated the New Orleans Red Light District, but ran in the great tradition of most river towns, where prohibition was more of an abstract thought, belonging more in Sunday morning sermons than everyday life. As war came, so did soldiers, in droves to port towns. This could be a big boom for business, but it could also mean more trouble than usual. Nellie Jackson operated a brothel for more than 60 years and was a beloved town matron in Natchez for her generosity to her community. Nellie also had more protection due to a secret life, informing for the FBI during the Civil Rights era. She was 87 years old and had lived a long and extraordinary life before a disgruntled would-be patron brutally attacked her in 1990. Welcome to episode 145, The Legend of Nellie Jackson. Thousands of years ago, numerous Native American tribes started settling in the area that is now known as the Lower Mississippi River Valley. The Chickasaw settled in the north, the Choctaw in the central area, and the Natchez, who were among one of the last tribes to arrive in that area, settled in the southern part, which is where this episode's story takes place. Looking for a way to make trading among the tribes more easy and accessible, the Natchez, Choctaw, and Chickasaw people worked together to develop the Natchez Trace, a travel corridor connecting the Cumberland, Tennessee, and Mississippi rivers. The trace began in what's now Nashville, Tennessee, and continued southwest 444 miles to present-day Natchez, Mississippi. Along the trace, the tribe started establishing more permanent settlements. The Natchez constructed hundreds of flat-topped ceremonial mounds and built communities around them, with tribe members living on farmland dispersed throughout. On August 3, 1716, the French established Fort Rosalie, which is essentially Natchez, Mississippi today, on a bluff that sits 200 feet above the Mississippi River. The Natchez were not about to sit by and just watch these strangers steal their land. Tensions rose, and by 1729, the Natchez had had enough and rebelled against the French, resulting in a war that became known as the French and Indian War, which the Natchez lost, with devastating casualty numbers. The Natchez people were almost completely wiped out. And in 1763, at the conclusion of the war, ownership of Fort Rosalie was transferred to England. But 13 years later, it was captured by a Spanish expedition party and remained under Spanish control until 1798, when the Mississippi Territory was established. In 1803, the settlement formerly known as Fort Rosalie was incorporated and named after the tribe whose land had been stolen, Natchez. 14 years later, the western half of the territory was admitted to the Union as the state of Mississippi, with the other half becoming Alabama, and people started flocking to the area to farm cotton, which grew in abundance in Mississippi's rich soil. By 1860, Mississippi was the nation's top producer of cotton, fortunes made on the backs of thousands of enslaved people, cotton was king, as they said. In the decades before the Civil War, Natchez was one of the most prevalent slave trading cities, second only to New Orleans in the United States. But this was also the year that Abraham Lincoln was elected. As an anti-slavery northerner, Lincoln vowed to abolish the very thing making southern farmers successful, slavery. Mississippi and six other states seceded from the Union and formed the Confederacy, starting a war that polite folks insisted was just about states' rights, not about the rights of wealthy plantation owners to keep human beings as chattel. Enslaved people were their legal property and free labor before the Civil War. The brutal four-year war devastated the United States before the Confederacy surrendered in 1865. More than 600,000 men were dead, millions were injured, and the South was left in ruin for most part. Cities that didn't hold strategic positions during the war, like Natchez, Mississippi, suffered less damage. This made the rebuilding process much easier, and the Natchez people were able to save more than 1,000 structures, which are now on the National Register of Historic Places. With the war over, Natchez had less than 9,000 residents, but with their location right on the Mississippi River, they became one of the state's leading producers of wood pulp, lumber, petroleum, and other commodities. All of that brings us to the early 1900s, where our story officially begins. On August 3, 1902, Jim and Inez Jackson welcomed a set of twin girls, Nellie and Frances, to their home in Possum Corner, a very rural, unincorporated community located about 30 miles south of Natchez. Being black in the Deep South was still very much a battle to survive during that time, and the Jackson family lived in extreme poverty. Not much is known about Nellie Jackson's childhood, except that she left school after the fifth grade, and in 1918, at 15 years old, she married a 22-year-old man named Wiley Barnes. In 1923, the Barnes couple moved from Possum Corner to Natchez, and a year later, they were divorced. Nellie's great-niece told the producers of the documentary Mississippi Madam that Nellie only married Wiley as a way to get into the city. Once they were in Natchez, she had what she needed and moved on. Following her divorce, Nellie started working at a bar in Under the Hill, an area filled with brothels, gambling houses, saloons, and other establishments not really acknowledged by polite society. Located on the boat landing under the bluffs the city of Natchez proper is built on, Under the Hill had been around since at least 1776 when the Spanish had control of Fort Rosalie. According to the Mississippi Encyclopedia, from the very beginning, the area was notorious for lawlessness, debauchery, and violence. It was the perfect place for boatmen, travelers, and poor townspeople to spend their free time, including Native Americans still in the area and enslaved people whose owners allowed them minimal time off, usually on Sundays, with just a few pennies in their pockets. Mixed with the understandable anger and resentment of these people was an abundance of whiskey, which led to lots of fights and even a few riots. Since the very beginning of Under the Hill's existence, many residents and officials wanted to clean it up or shut it down, but they were typically unsuccessful. In 1792, the governor of the Natchez District issued laws banning gambling, public rowdiness, and liquor sales to slaves and Indians. Laws that were largely ignored by proprietors, who didn't care what color a person was as long as their money was good. The governor also instituted a curfew, but no official was able to enforce it. 6 years later, the Mississippi Territorial Government banned the sale of liquor to Indians, and a year later they set up a law to regulate slave activity on Sundays. None of these laws worked like they were supposed to, and Under the Hill continued to operate however it wanted. In 1816, officials tried to shut down brothels by forcing all sex workers they could find onto boats, then shipping them to other ports. But this attempt didn't work, as many of the workers came back. 20 years later, officials tried to shut down gambling by telling the gamblers to leave the landing within 24 hours or face consequences. Many did leave, with all their worldly possessions, but they soon came back. However, the ones who did come back might have been out for vengeance, as a string of destructive fires soon broke out in Under the Hill. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. By the end of the 1830s, most of the Under the Hill gamblers had left the area for good, giving Natchez officials the ability to clean up the area as they saw fit. After numerous saloons and brothels were closed and replaced by commercial establishments, Under the Hill continued to operate as an illegal red light district, but on a much smaller and less violent scale. Under the Hill changed again in 1908 when Mississippi became the first state to pass a form of prohibition. That didn't mean Mississippi residents weren't drinking, and the state government knew it, so they would impose various forms of penalty tax on liquor. And as long as the tax was paid, officials would typically look the other way. In 1923, when 21-year-old Nellie Jackson started working at a bar in Under the Hill, prohibition was still around, so what Nellie was doing to pay the bills was illegal. She was even arrested at least once for bootlegging in the summer of 1928. She was fined $100 and given a 30-day jail sentence. But Nellie didn't let the fine and sentence stop her from making money. She continued working in Under the Hill, but she wanted more out of her life. And at this time, the career options for a black woman like Nellie were basically housekeepers or nannies, at best. But Nellie Jackson wanted more and was determined to get it. Her opportunity for the way of living she dreamed about came in 1930, when a friend told her about a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house for sale at 416 North Rankin Street, located on a corner bluff just a few blocks from downtown Natchez. At the time, this area was sort of like Under the Hill, with bars and bordellos, but there were also regular homes mixed throughout. Knowing Rankin Street had a vibrant nightlife, Nellie was very interested in the house, not to make a home in, but to use as a bordello. While prostitution was mostly criminalized in the early 1900s, the laws did little to actually shut the industry down, and many areas continued on as if there were no laws. Especially the towns along the Mississippi River, which were more liberal and free. So opening a bordello wasn't really going to be that much of an issue for Nellie, just like bootlegging during Prohibition wasn't. That being said, Nellie knew she needed to be careful about which details of her career she'd reveal to others. So whenever anyone asked if she did own a brothel, she planned to say she owned a boarding house. She rented rooms to girls, and whatever they did in their rooms was none of her business. It was all very wink-wink, but it worked. After buying the house at 416 North Rankin, Nellie started prepping it for its intended purpose. She claimed one bedroom as her own and outfitted the other two with a bed and a face bowl, which the girls could use to wash themselves off. Nellie designed the layout of the house so that customers would arrive at the back of the house and wait for Nellie to greet them. After answering the door, she would lead them through the kitchen to the living room, which was set up as a waiting room of sorts. There was a jukebox, couches, a dining table, stuff to keep customers comfortable while they waited. When the girls were ready, they would come out of the bedrooms and parade around the living room. The customer would then pick their girl, prepay Nellie, and then go into a bedroom. When it came to the exterior of the house, Nellie did not want it to scream bordello, so she made sure everything was nondescript. It was painted white with red trim and doors. The only sign that the house was anything but your normal family home was the screen door, which featured a metal cutout of a woman wearing a hoop skirt with a man bowing in front of her. After setting up the bordello, all Nellie needed now were the girls. While it's unclear how she hired her first employees, it's safe to assume she did know some sex workers from her time working in Under the Hill. What we do know for sure about Nellie's hiring process is that after opening the bordello, she would become known not for recruiting women, meaning that she didn't have to go out and find people to work for her, but she had such a great reputation that women from around the country would travel to Nellie for a job. She charged them a room rental and took 50% of their earnings. This meant that Nellie always had the most beautiful and sexy women of any bordello in the area. According to interviews from the documentary Mississippi Madam, Nellie had girls of every race working for her, white, black, Japanese. All women were welcome as long as they were beautiful. Nellie's Place officially opened in 1930. It wasn't the only bordello located on Rankin Street, but soon everyone found that it was the best. Besides having the most beautiful girls, Nellie's quickly earned a reputation for just simply being a good place to go. Nellie went the extra mile to make sure her girls and her clients were all comfortable and well taken care of. She was able to provide this sort of environment by implementing some strict, yet necessary rules. Nellie did not allow customers to enter the house if they were on drugs or drunk. And possibly her strictest rule of all was no black men allowed as customers. At first glance, this rule may seem hypocritical, but you have to remember the time. She would get shut down in a millisecond if someone found out that a black man had sex with a white woman in her establishment. It just wasn't good for business. In addition to this stable environment, Nellie offered the promise of anonymity, and she never broke her word. If Nellie saw a customer out and about, she would act like she didn't know them unless they spoke to her first. She understood that people didn't want to be outed as bordello patrons. If a big shot was going to visit, Nellie would allow them to enter through a side entrance. Once inside, they'd have the whole living room to themselves while any regular customers were sent to the kitchen, which they didn't mind because there was a huge dining room table, Cokes, beer, and sometimes a warm home-cooked meal. Nellie knew how to cater to people, but she also knew how to cover her ass. She kept a black book of names. Any person of note that stepped foot in her house was listed. She had to have some sort of leverage in case anyone ever wanted to shut her down. If you watch the documentary Mississippi Madam, you see a few people describe this book specifically in detail, like it was a huge ledger. Others would prefer not to say whether or not the book even existed, while giving a knowing smile for the camera. For all these reasons, Nellie's Place was a great success through the 1930s. But starting in 1942, Nellie's Place became a sensation after America joined World War II and soldier recruits started arriving at Camp Van Dorn, an army training camp in southern Mississippi. Every Friday and Saturday, the soldiers were bused 60 miles north to Natchez, where they would enjoy the plethora of bordellos and saloons. And like the locals had, the soldiers quickly learned that Nellie's was the best place in town. Every time they were in Natchez, the soldiers would line up and down the block, hoping to visit one of Nellie's girls. You can see photos of this in the documentary. With all these soldiers, Nellie made a lot of money, which she made sure to put right back into the community, eventually becoming one of the biggest benefactors in the town. Nellie always took care of the people in her neighborhood. If the neighborhood kids needed anything, school supplies, food, whatever, she would get it for them without being asked. Every Easter, Christmas, and even Valentine's Day, Nellie gave all the neighborhood kids presents. And on Thanksgiving, she made sure everyone had a turkey. And when some of those neighborhood kids were old enough, she hired them to do small jobs for her, like running errands, cleaning up, and cooking meals. Because Nellie provided so much to the community, and her business didn't really hurt anyone, authorities were willing to look the other way when it came to her operating an illegal business. Of course, this led to a lot of rumors and conspiracy theories about Nellie, about how no one could touch her because she owned all the cops in town, or that she had ties to the mob. But Nellie's family and authorities both say this is not true. Up until the early 1950s, Nellie didn't appear to have any issues running the bordello. But starting in 1953, that would change after officials shut her down via court order. We aren't sure how they got the court order because articles do not specify it, nor was it in the FBI files. But Nellie ignored the order and continued to operate, which led to a $1,000 fine and 6 months in jail. Lucky for her, she was let out early on good behavior. But the 1950s continued to get worse for Nellie. On June 1st, 1957, one of her employees was attacked by a client. 39-year-old Estelle Hurst's throat was slit from ear to ear by a recently discharged soldier, 24-year-old James Guy. When authorities tracked Guy down, they noticed two things. He was still carrying the bloody knife he had used to kill Estelle, and they said he had a crazy look in his eye. Guy admitted to killing Estelle over a $2 fee he didn't want to pay. At first, he pleaded insanity, but later, he pleaded guilty to manslaughter and served 20 years in the Parchment Penitentiary. Following the murder of Estelle, Nellie was arrested for operating a house of assignation. Before the end of June 1957, she was fined $1,000 and sentenced to 6 months in jail, which this time she served every day of. Since many locals thought Nellie owned the cops, the rumor around town was that she had a private cell outfitted with special things like a padded sofa. A local newspaper even reported that Nellie had a private telephone in her cell, which she used to run her business from behind bars. The town sheriff has since refuted these rumors, saying Nellie did not run her business from jail. She did have a private cell located away from the general population, but that was only because she was a woman and they were not used to housing female inmates at that time. Regardless of her cell conditions, when Nellie was done serving her time, she went right back to operating her business. She did, however, implement a system where she could make sure the girls were okay by keeping track of how long each client was supposed to be in a room for. When their time was up, Nellie would go to the door and knock and ask the girl, "Are you okay?" If she said yes, Nellie went on her way. If they said no, well, Nellie always had a gun on her and she wasn't afraid to use it. By the end of the 50s, Nellie seemed to have a handle on the situation inside her bordello, but outside, the world was burning around her. There had been a recent resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan following a landmark Supreme Court decision and the Brown v. Board of Education case, which abolished segregation in schools. The resurgence led to increased violence towards Black people, which only worsened when they started fighting for the right to vote. For years, as the civil rights movement grew in numbers, so did the opposition. Whenever and wherever Black people held demonstrations or protested, the Klan would gain members. They thought of themselves as vigilantes, protecting America from the coming invasion, from the war Martin Luther King Jr. was leading against white people. Their main goal was to completely shut down the civil rights movement under any means necessary. And usually, that meant inciting fear and intimidation through violence. By the early 1960s, there were numerous KKK groups throughout the South, but there wasn't one in Mississippi yet, at least not a major one. In early 1964, J.D. Swenson, the national Klegel of the original Knights of the KKK of Louisiana, went to Mississippi to recruit new members. He was successful. But not long after, members discovered Swenson had been pocketing quite a bit of money from initiation fees and robe sales. The members weren't happy, and the Klan split. Some stayed with the original Knights in Louisiana, while the others formed the White Knights of the KKK of Mississippi, which would become the largest Klan in the state. Within a year, they gained around 6,000 members and established claverns in over half the counties. For the rest of 1964, the White Knights wreaked havoc on southwestern Mississippi, especially in Natchez, where violence became so frequent, the FBI opened an office there. Civil rights protesters were physically attacked during demonstrations, and at home, Black people were terrorized. They faced threatening phone calls, armed Klansmen standing outside their doors, trash dumped on their lawns, stink bombs thrown into their homes, crosses burned in their yards, and so much more. When these acts of violence didn't keep people from protesting for their rights, the KKK kicked it up a notch. They kidnapped Black people, took them to fields and whipped them, shot into the homes of Black people, bombed businesses owned by Black people, and worse. By May 1964, 5 Black people had been murdered, and others had mysteriously disappeared, never to be seen again. Many of these crimes were reported to authorities, but due to corruption within the system, the crimes would mostly go ignored or be covered up. Few sheriffs took a public stance against the Klan or any other vigilante group. It was very much the civil rights activists versus everyone else. They didn't have a lot of help or protection, besides from the FBI, who was actively fighting the KKK. But no matter how terrified activists were to leave their homes, they continued to fight for their rights, and not hiding behind hoods like Klansmen, but out in the open, with the threat of death constantly looming over them. In reality, the Klan's violence, fear, and intimidation only made the movement stronger, and they were determined to not let the white supremacists win. So they came up with the Freedom Summer, a 3-month campaign to register as many black people as possible to vote in Mississippi. After the white knights found out about Freedom Summer, they wanted to punish those who helped make it possible. They put the word out that they wanted to murder 24-year-old Michael Schwerner, a Jewish volunteer who set up a voting drive in Neshoba County. On June 16th, the Klan received a tip that Schwerner would be attending a meeting at a local church, so a mob of armed men was sent to get him. But Schwerner wasn't there, so the Klansmen just lit the church on fire and beat the churchgoers. On June 20th, the Klan found out that Schwerner and two other volunteers, James Cheney, a black activist, and Andrew Goodman, a Jewish volunteer, went to the church to investigate the fire. When the Klan found out, they started making preparations. The next afternoon, the three activists returned to the church to interview witnesses and stopped when it was time to drive to a meeting. They hopped in a station wagon and were headed into Philadelphia, Mississippi, when a county deputy named Cecil Price pulled them over and arrested them for allegedly speeding. Less than 5 hours later, the three men were released and they were last seen driving towards Meridian. They had no idea that Deputy Price was working with the KKK. When Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman didn't check in with the other activists, they were reported missing. By the next morning, the FBI had been asked to come in and investigate. They started interviewing people, and on June 23rd, they found the station wagon. It had been torched, but there were no bodies inside, leading the FBI to name the case M.I. Byrne for Mississippi Burning. Starting on June 24th and for weeks after, the FBI and National Guard scoured the area for the three activists, while the rest of America looked on with horror. The majority of Americans grew so outraged with the treatment of black people that on July 2nd, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, prohibiting discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. But the KKK did not give up. They continued to attack civil rights activists. They beat Freedom Summer volunteers, torched or bombed black churches, homes, businesses, and more. Meanwhile, the FBI was still trying to find Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. After searching for weeks and not finding them, they put pressure on known Klan's members and developed informants to infiltrate the KKK. One of those informants was Nellie Jackson, the Mississippi Madam. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Online Therapy. You will probably drop anything to help someone you love. Why is it we go out of our way to show up for others, but sometimes ignore our own needs? So this month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you that you matter just as much as everyone else does, and therapy is a great way to make sure you show up for yourself. I consider therapy an integral part of my overall wellness, but I have a crazy schedule and I'm always on deadline. BetterHelp makes it so easy to stay in touch with myself and my needs. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/Southern. That's BETTERHELP.com/Southern. I am a to-do list nerd. With everything in my life, there is a list, including personal goals. On the top of that list right now is learning a new language with Babbel, the new learning app that's sold more than 10 million subscriptions. Babbel teaches bite-sized language lessons for the real world. The 15-minute lessons make it a perfect way to learn a new language on the go. I studied French from high school to college, and I've always noticed I can pick up words in other romance languages. So I'm using Babbel to learn Spanish. The app is easy to navigate, and the lessons are fun and engaging. You can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. You can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to Babbel.com and use promo code SFTC. That's BABBEL.com code SFTC. Babbel, language for life. Although they often burned crosses next to Nellie's place, Klansmen were some of the Bordello's biggest customers. So while it's unknown exactly how Nellie got involved in helping the FBI, it can be assumed she did do it to bring down the KKK. A way to get back at the hypocritical men who claimed to hate black people while also being more than willing to come to her place and pay to have sex with a black woman. Nellie and FBI agents came up with a plan. Her employees would get information out of their Klansmen clients and pass it on to Nellie, who would then meet with the FBI agents. The agents would only show up to the Bordello when the place was empty, which was usually between 3 and 4 a.m. They'd all meet in Nellie's bedroom, where she'd give them a couple of beers or coffees and tell them what she knew. It's unclear exactly how much of or what kind of information Nellie gave the FBI, but according to Agent Billy Williams, quote, "she was a lot of help to us." One thing is for certain, Nellie and her employees risked their lives by helping the FBI. On August 4th, a tip from an informant led the FBI to a local farm. 14 feet below an earthen dam, they found the bodies of Michael Schwerner, James Chaney, and Andrew Goodman, who had all been brutally murdered. By the end of the year, 18 suspects, including Deputy Price, who arrested the activists for speeding, were indicted and arrested. However, none of these people were held responsible for the senseless murders. That is until 2005, when a man named Edgar Killeen was convicted on 3 counts of manslaughter, after a jury found that he planned and directed the killings. At that time, he was 80 years old and was sentenced to 60 years. He died in prison at 92 years old. Back in 1964, the KKK continued its violence, but the FBI stayed in the area through the 60s and for the most part was successful in eradicating the group, at least the blatantly violent parts. In the late 60s, Nellie and a bunch of other Bordellos were investigated by the FBI for interstate transportation in aid of racketeering, for prostitution, but no charges were filed against Nellie, basically because there was no evidence that she was trafficking sex workers. Nellie continued operating her Bordello while still telling everyone that she was just a boarding house owner. And for the most part, it doesn't seem like anyone cared. Natchez has gambling, drinking, and prostitution in its roots, after all. Over the next few decades, because she was openly operating an illegal business that officials didn't shut down, Nellie became a different sort of sensation than she had ever been before. It's almost as if she went viral. People around the world would travel to Natchez to visit Nellie's and get one of her famous t-shirts, which said, "Follow me to Nellie's, Natchez, Mississippi." Meanwhile, Nellie continued her charitable ways while spending free time snuggling her toy poodles, traveling to her vacation homes in other states, and attending World Series games, her favorite team being the LA Dodgers. And after getting married in March 1976, Nellie and her husband Jim frequently traveled to Vegas for fun. But that marriage ended after Jim withdrew $90,000 from their bank account before disappearing for 3 months. Nellie tracked him down to a New Orleans jail and learned that he had a wife and kids he had never told her about. She filed for divorce. By the time the 80s arrived, Nellie's was still operating. Some may balk at the idea of a bordello being allowed to operate out in the open during the 1980s, but other towns along the river also had bordellos. It wasn't like Nellie's place was special, at least in that sense. In 1982, Nellie turned 80, but that did not stop her from getting into trouble every now and then. That year, she was arrested after shooting a man in the butt after he peeked in one of her windows. The grand jury declined to indict her for assault, and she went on with her life. Later that same year, UPI published a long piece about Nellie, her bordello, and how Natchez felt about it still operating. The reporter, Michael O. Fowler, wrote that most Natchez residents didn't look down on Nellie for her profession. Instead, they focused on her generous spirit. One local man named Skip told UPI, "She is the original golden-hearted madam." Even the longtime mayor, Tony Byrne, shared his support for Nellie, saying, "We know it exists. It should exist. It's the oldest profession in the world. I think it should be legalized. We can get by with Nellie's operating. Everybody knows about it." With that being said, Natchez was very religious in the 1980s, and while many church folk could get past Nellie's career because she was so generous, there were some who couldn't or wouldn't. In fact, following the UPI article's publication, numerous ministers lambasted Mayor Byrne for supporting illegal activities, one saying that by allowing Nellie to operate, officials were condoning the, quote, breaking of the law. "It's an insult to every decent, law-abiding citizen who desires a wholesome atmosphere in which to rear his family. It's a rotten example for the youth of our city." The minister's words had no effect on Nellie, who kept on doing her thing. The UPI article sparked a new wave of interest in Nellie's, and a few years later, in 1985, another article about Nellie's was released, this time by the Clarion Ledger. Just like with the UPI article, the Clarion Ledger wrote about how much people loved Nellie and didn't have any intention of shutting her down. Police Chief Ken Fairley told the paper, quote, "Nellie Jackson is as much a part of Natchez as Main Street. I had just as soon try to shut down the Mississippi River Bridge because the people would not put up with it." Ron Miller, director of the historic Natchez Foundation, added, "I think there's a certain fondness, if not for Nellie's business, but for Nellie's. It adds a little spice to Natchez, a little odd quirk." Sadly, that spice would soon be tragically stolen from the town. After the 4th of July in 1990, 87-year-old Nellie was running the bordello like she had for the last 60 years. At some point after midnight, she heard knocking at the screen door, which was near her bed. She answered and found a 20-year-old drunk and belligerent college student named Eric Brazil. As everyone knows, Nellie did not allow drunk people into her establishment, so she turned him away, which made Brazil angry. He screamed and cursed at Nellie before finally leaving. But he didn't go home. Instead, he walked 2.5 blocks to a gas station and bought an ice chest. After filling it with gas, he carried the cooler back to Nellie's place, sloshing gas all over himself as he walked. At around 5 a.m., Brazil poured gas on the bordello's porch, then approached the screen door, which was latched. However, the inside door was cracked open, leaving enough room for him to toss some gas through the screen door, into the crack, and onto Nellie, who was lying on the bed. He lit the gas, which caught Nellie and the house on fire. But what Brazil didn't expect was to light himself on fire, too. He burst into flame, and as one neighbor described it, he looked like a ball of fire that shot across the street. He ran, flailing his arms, into a nearby field, while neighbors frantically called 911. An officer just happened to be driving by when he saw Brazil on fire standing in the road, waving his arms around. The officer stopped to help him, eventually putting him in an ambulance, where he was then rushed to the hospital with first, second, and third degree burns over 69% of his body. Meanwhile, emergency crews showed up and extinguished the house fire as a handful of girls in lingerie poured out, screaming to everyone that Miss Nellie was still inside. Firefighters made their way into Nellie's bedroom and quickly located her. She was lying on the floor near her bed. All of her hair and clothes had been burned off. But Nellie, always a fighter, was still breathing. So she was rushed to the hospital in critical condition, having suffered first, second, and third degree burns over 100% of her body. One firefighter interviewed for the documentary said that one of Nellie's dogs was killed in the fire and was found lying next to her. Her other dog survived because he was hiding under her bed. When firefighters let him out of the house, he ran right back inside to his mistress. A few hours after arriving at the hospital, Nellie and Brazil were both transferred via separate helicopters to a burn center in Greenville. Nellie never recovered, and 6 days after the attack, she succumbed to her injuries. Residents of Natchez were devastated. They had lost a pillar of the community in a senseless, tragic attack. Death by fire is particularly horrific and painful. To think she suffered that much and still lived for a few days is actually awful. The first firefighters on the scene thought she was already dead until one knelt down next to her and realized she was breathing and alert. Following Nellie's death, authorities reported that Brazil's vital signs were stable and promised that if he did survive, he would be charged with capital murder, which could result in the death penalty. But Eric Brazil did not survive. 15 days after setting fire to Nellie's house, he died from a cerebral hemorrhage, effectively closing the case of the murder of 87-year-old Nellie Jackson. On July 16th, a funeral was held for Nellie at St. Mary's Episcopal Church. Around 100 people were in attendance, as Father David O'Connor officiated. Some churchgoers were angry that the priest was willing to officiate Nellie's funeral, giving her a proper Christian burial. They felt she didn't deserve one, that Nellie's murder was the Lord's vengeance. She got what she deserved. They were happy the, quote, black whore was dead. Father O'Connor did not mention Nellie's bordello at the funeral, but the weekend after, he gave a very passionate sermon about judgment, aimed squarely at the people who said those horrible things about Nellie Jackson. The normally soft-spoken, peaceful preaching man of God gave his first ever fire and brimstone sermon defending the beloved madam. Nellie's place never reopened, and over the next 20 years was destroyed from the inside out by people who just wanted a souvenir. They would show up and take whatever they wanted, a door, window, brick, anything to show they had been to the famous Nellie's. During this time, Nellie Jackson remained a household name in Natchez, Mississippi. But the story of all the legendary things she did slowly faded away for the rest of the world. In 2014, filmmakers Mark Brockway and Timothy Givens decided the world needed to remember Nellie's story. So they started working on the documentary Mississippi Madam. Brockway and Givens conducted extensive research and interviewed nearly 200 people who knew Nellie. Not a single one of them had a bad word to say about her. In a Natchez Democrat article about the documentary's 2017 premiere, Brockway said, "I am unabashedly an admirer of hers and what she did. She thumbed her nose at what Mississippi told her her life should be. You can question her business, but you can't question her determination, her business acumen, and her tenacity." Mississippi Madam was well received and caused a new surge of interest in Nellie Jackson. So much so that in 2020, a longtime Natchez citizen named J.T. Robinson purchased Nellie's place with the goal of restoring it. For 40 years, Robinson had worked for the local telephone company. And during that time, he made several service calls to Nellie's place. Robinson told the Natchez Democrat, quote, "She was a very pleasant, professional lady, and I was truly distracted by the girls and trying my best to do my job and leave." Robinson told the Natchez Democrat that he purchased Nellie's house because he, quote, "didn't want to see Nellie's and the significant history and legend behind it get lost to the wear and tear of time and neglect. His dream is to turn the house into a bed and breakfast, with a museum for Nellie herself. Robinson estimated it would take at least a year to get Nellie's up and running, and there hasn't been an update on the renovation status since 2020, the beginning of the pandemic. However, in September 2021, author Roscoe Barnes III wrote on his blog, Roscoe Reporting, that he had met with J.T. Robinson and toured the house. By the looks of the blog, it appears that Robinson is still planning to open up the house as a tourist attraction. Nellie Jackson is a legend for so many reasons. She was a remarkable businesswoman, no matter what you might think of her type of business. She treated her employees as well as she did her clients. She gave generously, not just to charities, but to anyone in her community who needed help. She ran a successful bordello during all different times of crisis in the 20th century. She survived the Great Depression, wars, and was, according to one activist interviewed, a soldier for the civil rights movement in Mississippi. She was fearless, and she was peerless. There never has been, nor will there ever be, another Nellie Jackson. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Haley Gray with additional writing by me. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Thank you to Shayna Hayes for suggesting the incredible story of Nellie Jackson. If you have any case suggestions, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, and go to the listener suggestion tab. And if you have submitted a case suggestion in the last few months, please resubmit it on the website. I was very overwhelmed by email when I came back from my sick leave, and I have never caught up. This is the best way for me to get those little-known cases y'all always send me. Please remember that I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. With 3 platforms to manage, that is also very overwhelming for me. I hope you understand. But please, come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. I much prefer spending my social media time in our lovely group. We do, of course, discuss true crime, not just Southern Fried, but all kinds. But it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.